You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
Hi everyone, I'm Ben Kiebrick, co-executive producer for the program and today's host. In this episode, you will hear from John Carlos, a lifetime advocate for human rights, best known for his part in the silent protest at the Mexico City Olympics in 1968. Joining the program today is Shannon Carter, Associate Professor of English from Texas A&M Commerce. I invited Shannon to introduce our recording of Carlos's featured session, which he delivered at the Four Seas Conference in Las Vegas last March. You can find a link to the description of this session on our website, as well as the 10-minute video that accompanied Carter's introduction to Dr. Carlos in Vegas. The video provides details referenced in Carlos's remarks over the next hour, the conditions of racism that John Carlos's actions responded to, his childhood in Harlem, how he got involved with the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and other details about how the silent protest was developed and interpreted in its time. It is an important video, and we hope listeners take a look. To give a bit of that context, and to also set up Dr. Carlos's keynote address, Shannon Carter, who has been working with Dr. Carlos and other activists with links to her university, will set the scene.
We all know the image, even those listeners born long after the event took place. Three sprinters on the victory stand in Mexico City in 1968, demonstrating their solidarity with those suffering injustices around the globe. Each wear a button for the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Australian Peter Norman faces straight ahead. Americans Tommy Smith and John Carlos each raise a black-gloved fist, heads bowed. Carlos's jacket is open, beads around his neck. Smith wears a black scarf. Neither wears shoes. At the first games to be televised in color, this controversial statement was broadcast around the world into the living rooms of millions of viewers. That image alone is enough to keep rhetoricians busy for some time. In his remarks, Carlos describes the intended meaning behind these symbols. We'll get to that soon, but before we do, I'd like to identify three themes that seem particularly relevant to our field. After hearing from Carlos, I'll return with some concluding remarks, including potential implications for rhetoric in everyday life. Everywhere. Time plays a significant role in this rhetorical event. It took about 20 minutes to pull together and ended just moments after it began. Almost as quickly, Olympic officials and mainstream media had effectively dismissed, distorted, and ultimately silenced that message. The demonstration may have happened quickly, but like all such efforts, its roots are very long and impact far-reaching. It was fast, but not spontaneous. Their intended message took years of careful, deliberate planning. That long fight against racism is perhaps most clearly represented by the OPHR button on each demonstrator's chest. In his remarks over the next hour, Carlos indicates a lifetime of preparation for this moment, one deeply informed by the civil rights movement and related efforts spanning centuries. A second theme is collective action and its contrast to individual action. The silent protest took two people to pull together, three to execute, and dozens more to plan. Even the movement that gave rise to their demonstration was fueled by scores of others. We often remember the civil rights movement as a series of dramatic actions by heroic individuals, but that's just not how change works. Rosa Parks may have helped launch the civil rights movement by refusing to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. However, that decision was not spontaneous either. Like the silent protest in Mexico City more than a decade later, that bus demonstration took multiple community organizers and years of careful planning. Parks and Carlos are indeed heroes. However, the myth of individualism often forces us to ignore some of the most heroic aspects of their work. These are studied, intellectual, deliberately rhetorical projects as much as they are acts of courage. Others have said this, but more of our students need to know this. From this perspective, change seems more complex, yet somehow more accessible. But we must never forget the price paid by such figures. Carlos Smith and their loved ones paid dearly for their public demonstrations. MLK and Malcolm X gave their lives. We have to insist on the role played by collective action, but it seems that we must also continue to honor the extreme sacrifices made by those on the front lines. The final theme concerns reciprocity, which I approach as a key component in collective action. From the very beginning, Carlos and the activists informing our project have been what Jacqueline Jones Royster calls co-knowledge makers. In his opening remarks, Carlos introduces two other co-knowledge makers, Joe Tave and Belford Page, both of whom, like Carlos, attended my university in the late 1960s, which had then only recently desegregated. Carlos, Tave, Paige, and countless others have worked closely with us on a range of projects about area race relations. In Vegas for 4Cs, we were co-panelists on two panels on East Texas activism. This summer, Carlos and I are co-authoring a scholarly article that frames these experiences for our field in many of the same ways that I'd have here. Other related projects with area advocates will follow, including another planned article with Tate.
The title for Dr. Carlos's presentation is The Silent Protest, Open Hands, Closed Fists, and Composition's Political Turn. This title, of course, refers to Edward Corbett's The Rhetoric of the Open Hand and The Rhetoric of the Closed Fist, which appeared in the Three Seas Journal in 1969. Carter goes on to explain how the life and actions of John Carlos relate to our work in the field.
The silent protest and its aftermath, as we explain in the program description for this session, quote, graphically illustrates both the power of Corbett's closed fists and the excruciating limits of his open hand. It also calls upon us to consider our organization's shifting position on the relationship between the classroom and the rest of society. Carlos addresses those tensions at some length in his presentation, demonstrating throughout the importance of what Nancy Welsh has called uncivil rhetoric, and as opposed to civil rhetoric, the open hand. As she explains in a recent article, quote, civility functions to hold in check agitation against a social order that is undemocratic in access to decision-making voice and unequal in distribution of wealth. Carlos's life story is filled with examples of this uncivil rhetoric that Welsh identifies as vital to our ongoing quest for social justice. Throughout his talk, he continues to remind us that such battles are necessary and yet they are also far from over. There's much work that needs to be done. 45 years later, the closed fist of the silent protest resonates as never before. It's time for us to return to this iconic moment and take stock.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. John Carlos.
Look behind me. I always have to start off by saying I really appreciate the applause, the love that you guys are expressing. But from this point on, if anyone applauds, we're going to have you removed from the auditorium. I'm not here for applause. I'm here just trying to convey a message. First, before I do anything, let me introduce my wife, because without my wife, I wouldn't be here. She saved me too many times. My wife, Charlene Carlos. Now, you know, to have books and not have bookends, it wouldn't be no purpose to have the books. So, you know, I have guys that have been with me in my career before and after. I see one of them here, and I would hope the other one is here too. Mr. Joe Tave, you just saw Mr. Tave. Would you stand up, Mr. Tave, let them see who you are. We have another fellow here that's supposed to be after Mexico, by the name of Belfry Page. I don't know whether Mr. Page is in the house. Should be. But in any case, these two individuals were like my bookends. Here's an individual that was with me at the trying times at East Texas State. Joe was there like solid as a rock. And when I say solid as a rock, I'm talking about in regards to the fact that when I left East Texas State, he didn't lay down. He picked the ball up and he decided, I'm going to run this touchdown. And he organized and did a tremendous amount of work on that campus to resurrect the campus and have them have different views about how individuals should treat their fellow man. Mr. Page was one somewhat like I was as a youngster. He was kind of radical. So when he came in with the attitude that I love all people, but at the same time, I have a message for those that don't want to give the love back. So I respect both of them. Now I can get into a little bit about myself. Activism, you know, excuse me. When I started out, didn't start out to be no activist. I was a wide-eyed kid looking to find out what my niche was in life. I looked at the ladies. I always liked the girls. Used to love to play spin that bottle. And then I began to realize that it was more things just than other than the girls. As many questions I had, well, my compadres, as I might say, they couldn't answer the questions. I started going to the adults to ask them about why society the way it is. They couldn't answer. So I had to look for a higher power. That's how I got involved in my Lord, Jesus Christ. He had the answers. But how do you find him? I found a church, Abyssinia Baptist Church. I didn't know the great individuals that was heading up this church, but I felt I could get the answers I needed there. I got my family together. We organized ourselves, and on Sundays we would be in the first pew there at Abyssinia Baptist Church. And I began to realize at that particular time that we had a few standards of life. I remember sitting in the church one day and I asked my father, because Adam Clayton Powell Sr. came out and he was coughing like me. He said, I'm not feeling well today. I'm not going to preach the sermon, but I'm going to let my son preach. And I recall when he referred to his son, and it was a group of men standing over there, and I said to my father, I said, Pop, who is this son? And he pointed out to this fellow over here. He said, the one putting on the robe. Come on down, Mr. Page, sit down. We got a seat for you. I just mentioned you, man. They told me you was a late runner. But in any case, he pointed out, and he said, the fellow that's putting the robe on. And I said, oh, no, Pop, that can't be his son. That's a white man. My father said, no, son, that's his son. I looked back at my dad and said, Pop, it can't be his son. He said, he is. And he said to me something that stuck in my mind. He said, you know, he's not overzealous like the rest. And he said that because I asked him, I said, what do you mean overzealous? He said, well, son, some of them, you know, they try and pass. And that's the first time I heard that expression, pass. Pass for what? What's he passing from? So, well, he moves into the white world. He looks like a white person, although he's black, and he wants to live in their world. So I said to my father right away, Pop, are you telling me that these people are ashamed of being black? They're ashamed of who they are? And that's when he came and he said, no, they're not ashamed, but some of them are a little overzealous. And you know, when you sit back and you think about that time and you put it in present day, you think about people that leave from Haiti, they call immigrants, or people that leave from Mexico, they call immigrants, or people that leave from Cuba. And you think that maybe they don't like their nationality. They're trying to get away. It's not that they're trying to get away. It's not that, you know, those individuals that were passing were trying to get away. But what they were trying to do was have a better standard of life. I see, I think that's something that God guaranteed all of us through birth. But man had a strange way of changing things around. Like, for instance, you know, you're fighting about whether individuals should be allowed to smoke marijuana. God put marijuana on the earth for the indigenous people. Man took God's law and put it to the curb and put up some Johnny Walker Red, some rich Slits malt liquor, E&J. Now, for all you white folks out there, you didn't see it like I saw it, because I would see those signs 24/7. In my neighborhood, on one street, you find 4 bars and 2 liquor stores on one block. So it began to make me realize that something was broke. And I'm looking for the adults, the leaders, to fix it. I remember one night going to bed and waking up, and then there was a thing called white flight. All the white folks seemed like they had a meeting that we wasn't involved in, and they decided we're going to leave Harlem. Next day they was loading up. I asked my father, I said, Pop, why are they leaving? Where are they going? He said, well, I don't know why they're leaving, son, but I'm going to find out. He came back a few days later. He told me, he said, son, the word is they're leaving because they have so many domesticated workers that work for them. And it's very difficult for them to have a domesticated worker work for them and be their next door neighbor as well. So they decide they're going to get out of Dodge. So I looked at that. I looked at the fact that we had situations like in the agencies, the fire department or the police department, we weren't recognized. We didn't have any black firemen back in the 50s, back in New York. Not in Harlem, for sure. But I noticed at the same time, by being absent from the fire department, if we had a woman burn a pot of beans or some rice on the stove and it created a little smoke, They would walk through, and if anyone's here from New York, they could attest to the fact that in New York, you could have an apartment that had 5 bedrooms back there. They would walk through and chop up every piece of furniture, water down everything in the house, throw it out the front window on Lenox Avenue, throw it out the back window in the alley. And as soon as you walk through that front door, to the right or the left, the kitchen was right there. They could see it was no fire, but they would go back and chop up 5 bedrooms of furniture and throw it out. And I remember asking my father, I said, Pop, why'd they do that? My father looked at me like, son, are you crazy? It was a fire. No, Daddy, I need you to come outside. I can't, son. Daddy, I need you to come outside. So he stopped, he came out. I said, show me something burnt, Daddy. I'm a little boy. He said, wait a minute. He went over to the chief. I didn't need to go to the chief. I'm standing back and I'm looking. I don't see one fireman that represents me. And I began to realize this is something that happens in the corporate world. This is something that happens in education. And a lot of agencies, if we're not represented, if we're not in the meeting, they just pass over us. I don't think it's right for any ethnic group to be passed over. So as a young kid, whether I want to be this activist or not, that's the plan that God had for me. He had this plan so much to the point when I came into this world, my mother had problems with me before I was born. You know, they had this procedure, they used to move me around in my mom's womb 3 times. Well, actually 2 times. The third time he told my mother, say, Mrs. Collins, look like this baby has a mind of his own, leave it alone. I came into this world brief, baby, feet first. So that was an indication that obviously I was going to be doing something with these big feet I had. I began to run through the neighborhood. I began to become more inquisitive to the point when I heard a guy like Malcolm X come on the radio. Well, Malcolm X was the next man outside my father that made sense to me. And he was so sure of himself in terms of his delivery on the radio until I had to get there to see who this guy Malcolm X was. Well, when Malcolm X came into the place, I thought he was just someone coming to listen. Because I knew Malcolm X was blacker than black, blue black, because he was blowing so much black. And they told me, said, that's Malcolm X over there. I said, man, it can't be. That's him. But once he went to the podium and he began to speak, I knew right away it was him because it just set off all the chemicals in my body, just made me rise up. Because here's a man that was swimming upstream. I've always swum upstream and seemed like I'm always butting heads because everybody else is swimming downstream. This is the first time in my young life I see somebody swimming in the direction I'm swimming. So my thought was to listen to him as much as I could and then to build the courage up to approach him and ask him, is it possible I can go with you from one location to the next? He just looked at me the first couple of times. I said the third time, he said, well, why would you like to go with me? I said, to learn, to ask questions. And he smiled, he showed me his dimple then. And I said to him, I said, I want to ask questions because I want to learn to try and help people in my neighborhood. He said, all right, son, you can come if you can keep up. Now, right there, aside from me coming feet first, this was the first indication that I know that I'm going to be a runner, too, because I didn't understand what he meant, if you can keep up. He was a very fast walker, so I had to actually run, jog, to stay up with him to ask the questions. But as time went on, I began to realize that with many people in my neighborhood were starting to suffer. And when I say suffer, just like we had these tables here back in the 50s, we used to go to dinner. Every evening, we had a family unit. It was concerned about, hey, Mom, how did it go at the hospital last night? Hey, Pop, do you need me to do anything Saturday? Forget about Saturday, son. What did you do in school this week? We always had that family discussion. And then one night, boom, went to sleep, came back. They had this thing called King Kong, was a bootleg liquor. It's like modern day PCP. They drink this King Kong, you see guys fly off the roof to their death. Then King Kong left one night, and the next day, it was heroin. Came into the neighborhood. Well, heroin depleted families, fragmented families, and just altogether dissolved families. Even to this day, we still have many broken families. Mothers can only raise their kids to a certain age, particularly boys. They need a man figure in the house. Many black men are missing in action due to the drugs. But when I looked at that, and I looked at the fact that I was blessed because I had a mother and father that were strong in my household, and all of my friends, they didn't have that same situation. I go to their house and look in the cabinet, wasn't no food in the cabinet. Wasn't no clothes in the closet. But fortunately for me, along my travels, I looked at TV and I saw this guy used to wear this green suit and funny looking hat with feathers sticking out called Robin Hood. And I think Robin Hood impressed any minority kid, any poor kid. And I liked his character. So when I saw these individuals that didn't have, I began to analyze Robin Hood a little more. And I realized that Robin Hood realized the P was split down the middle. There was two laws. There was man's law and there was God's law. Just like it was man's liquor and God's marijuana. Understand? Two laws. So I realized right then that Robin Hood wasn't concerned about the sheriff of Nottingham. Robin Hood was concerned about making sure the people stopped being pillaged, the same way Jesus Christ went to the marketplace. So my job right then was to go right across the street, a bridge, 155th Street Bridge, to the freight trains. Now Mrs. Steinbrenner would probably not be too happy with me because they were his trains. But he had to pay taxes, which he wasn't paying. So my task for him was to break those seals, go in there, and I had three partners of mine. And I remember they used to tell me, said, Johnny, we're going to have fat pockets. I said, no, this is not for us. We're going to give this to the people in the neighborhood that don't have. Now, mind you, I was never taught to be a thief. My mother and father never played that role. They wouldn't allow it. They taught me to be obedient. They taught me to be intelligent. And they taught me to be honest and faithful. But when it came to honest and faithful, I had to recognize who I'm being honest and faithful to man or to God. God wouldn't let people go hungry. Like the churches today, you sit back and you look at churches today, the church is supposed to be the one to shelter people, to feed people, to clothe people. The churches don't do that today. So I took it upon myself with my partners to go in there and get this food and these clothes and take it and give it to the people in the community. It's just like right now in your neighborhood, you'll find a tree on the bottom of the hill. The tree done grown. We got so much foliage on it. It's grown. And right behind the foliage is a stop sign. People coming down that hill, they can't see the stop sign because the tree done grown so much. But 95% of the people in the community don't know who to pick the phone up and call and say, come cut this tree. They was in a quandary they didn't know how to get out of. I've been taught to believe in God. I've been taught to do the right thing. But I have not been taught how to survive in this society when everyone is trying to block me from having a faithful life. I took it upon myself to realize one day God sent the police to me. Actually sent the police to my dad. But my dad used to have a little poker game and crap game on the weekend for all the baseball players and police. And they went to my father and said, Earl, been some break-ins over at the Yankee Stadium and the freight yards. And we think Johnny's doing so and so. And you need to talk to him. My old man put his hand up. He said, nah, that's your job. He's right now at McCoon's Park, right across from the Yankee Stadium. Go over there and have a talk with him. Sure enough, they came over, they blocked the whole park. They walked up on me. Said, we need to talk to you. And Mr. Lester is about 6 feet. Mr. Bryant was about 6'7". Hands like this. Mr. Lester said, Sir John, there's been some break-ins and we think we know who is doing it. We haven't been able to catch him, but we gonna catch him. He leaned into my face. We gonna catch him. And Mr. Bryant said, well, tell him something, tell him the other thing. And he said, well, we wanna let you know you have a talent. I have a talent, what talent do I have? And Mr. Lester said, you're a runner. When he said I was a runner, just like you laughed, well, I kind of smirked. Mr. Bryant smacked me on this side of my face and his fingers landed over here. I see stars every time I think about that man. But anyway, he told me, he said to me, he said, John, He said, you're a runner and you're special. And I said, nah, I ain't no more special. And I smirked because when he said that I was a runner, my mom was a runner. My mom used to work at Bellevue Hospital at night. Someone snatched her purse one night, drug her down, cut up her legs, tore up her stockings. She came home. We was all concerned. It was all young men and my father. We was concerned about my mother's well-being. But my mom held up a purse and she said, yeah, they got my purse, but I got it back. She ran them down and got our purse back. So for me to tell Mr. Lester that everyone is a runner in the neighborhood, I'm telling the truth. He told me, he said, no, but you're special. And then he gave me a number, which started my career. He gave me a number to the New York Pioneer Club. Now, mind you, when I was in school, I was probably the dumb of the dumbest. Okay, a lot of people say, oh, you shouldn't say that, but it's the truth. It wasn't that I was dumb in terms of my intelligence. I had learning disabilities. I had dyslexia, but they was calling it just this dummy at that particular time. And they would put the dummy hat on you, write dummy down the center until you sit on that stool. That was me. But yet and still, as I began to work my way in this track program, I realized two things. I realized that God blessed me and gave me these talents as an athlete. But I realized even greater than that is how many smiles I brought on people's faces. And that's what I like to see, people smiling and happy. So I said, wow, this running track thing could be all right. And then I began to realize the better I got, the more I got to be a voice. The more you elevate yourself, whatever your profession is, the more you can become a voice. You can perfect it to the point where people are dying to hear what you have to say. But right, quite naturally, as I'm coming through it, I remember coming up in Harlem. I remember going to East Texas State when my name changed from John Collins to Boy. He calling me Boy, and I got a wife and a kid, just like he had a wife and a kid, but he gonna call me Boy in an instant. All the time he was recruiting me, Mr. Collins, John Collins, come on down. The minute I got off the plane and he turned the corner, my name changed to Boy. The minute I looked over his shoulder, I saw a sign talking about whites only, colors. I go over to the white water fountain. You can't drink out that water fountain. And I'm saying, where am I? I heard about the South, but I never thought Texas was part of the South. I thought that was just cowboys and Indians. So I go on, I get down to Texas, and I realize to myself then that they've never seen anybody like me in terms of my athletic ability, nor did they see anyone like me with the audacity that I had to be me. They wanted to turn me around and tell me this is the way it's supposed to go. You can't talk to this person. You can't go to this association. Don't hang with those guys in that fraternity. And I remember going one time, we was going to Arkansas to a track meet. Now, it rained from Texas straight into Arkansas. And when I say rain, if you've been in Texas, they got like torrential rain. There's no track beating would take place. But as we were leaving, we found this patch of sun. We in the back of the station wagon, and I saw an old man out there. And he had a harness around his neck. He had a white shirt on, some black trousers with his sleeves rolled up, and he had a mule. And his whole field out there, he looked like he had plowed his whole field. And before anybody could say anything, I had jumped out the back of the station wagon and rolled out there in the middle of the field. And I'm looking at this man. I said, what are you doing? He's telling me, he said, I'm doing my job. I said, man, they have tractors to do this. You don't have to do this. He said, I don't know nothing else to do. He's telling me, referring to whoever the man was that had owned the farm. He said, Mr. Jolly or whatever, let me do this all my life. I don't know nothing else to do. This is all I do. And I see I couldn't make no sense to him, but it made a lot of sense to myself because I was filled with tears. When I got back, and all my partners that was there, one of my real good friends, no longer here, Terry Barnett, white fella, I was mad at him. And I had no right to be mad at Terry because Terry didn't do anything, but I was mad for the system, the way the system pees on people. You know, say rain on my parade. They had a man here tell me long after slavery that this is all he knew to do. And then when we got down in Arkansas, finally, I wasn't no track meet. The coach risked everyone's life because he hadn't seen his twin brother. Knew it wasn't going to be a track meet. So I decided from that point on, now is no more shucking and jiving. Now it's about getting serious in terms of dealing with issues in society, in terms of how committed you are. You know, you guys are writers here. I wrote two books. The first book I wrote was called Why. Everybody used to always ask me, why you do this, why you do that. But I self-published the book, so you couldn't really get it out to the people. So I decided I'll leave it alone. But God came to me and he said, nah, man, you need to get a hold of this guy, David Zarin. Talk to David. I talked to David one time. David said, I don't have time. I'm busy. I'm doing so and so. Waited a year. Come back. God said, talk to David again. David, God didn't come back to me. He told me to talk to you again. Well, John, if I do the book, I want to do the book with you and Tommy Smith together. I said, David, that's great. But Tommy wrote a book, and he wasn't too nice in the book, the things that he said, and I just wanted to set the record straight. Nah, well, John, I'm really writing a couple books now, but I need to have you and Tommy agree to do this book together. Okay. See me next year. Well, God said, well, we're going to step it up. The next year when I went to him, he said, John, I still like to do the book, but just by the grace of God, here come Tommy Smith and his wife about 20 yards in back. I said, man, here's your lucky day. Well, there's Mrs. Smith and his wife. Go on back there and have a talk with him. He went back there, stayed 15 minutes. He came back. He said, all right, John, we're going to get started on your book tomorrow. In essence, what I'm trying to tell you is, if you want to write a story about the ills of society, you have to write this story pretty much like that book right there, the John Carlos story. Because we want to write this book, but we didn't want to write the book where people could read the book and then put it down. We wanted them to read this book and actually feel like they're walking down the street with John Carlos. When I hurt, I wanted them to hurt. When I laughed, I wanted them to laugh. When I shed tears, I wanted them to shed tears. I have so many people tell me, say, man, you know, I wasn't born in that era, but I feel like I lived through the era by the things that you put in this book. You, as the writers, are as much as I am on that victory stand putting my fist to the sky. You're the town criers. You have to be creative. Like Dr. Carter said, man, how much time did you have to orchestrate that demonstration? How much time did you have to bring it together? And I had to express to her, say, Dr. Carter, this only took 20 minutes for us to figure out what we was going to do. I said, but it took about 4 years of simmering. We had the pot on the stove and it was simmering. By the time we got to Mexico City, the fact that the boycott was called off, it was a matter of now the pot is boiling. Things haven't changed. The guys felt like they didn't want to go through the boycott. And here's reasons why they didn't want to go. And they was entitled to their reasons as much today as it was yesterday. Hey man, we feel that this boycott is necessary. Well, man, you know, I promised my church I was going to win the medal. Man, I promised my mom and father I was going to win. Man, I owe it to myself, man. I trained in the rain. I owe it to myself. I said, yeah, but what about the atrocities that happened throughout history? That no one said a prayer for those that came over in the maiden voyage. For those people that's down there in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that had the all entrepreneurship gone, that they just burned up and killed up, that nobody ever mentions anymore. What about Troy Davis's individuals like that? I say, what we need to do is let's have a ride on a hypothetical train. And you know why we had to take that ride? To make them understand 44 years later. See, 44 years earlier, you see the slogans that they put up there? Black skin stormtrooper. I was anti this, anti that. I was the most vilified person, probably because I was the most vocal person. But I wasn't going to let that deter me from what my mission was. And my mission is to reach one person in this auditorium today, just one person. And God tell me my job is done. So I say, are y'all ready to get on this train? You willing to ride with me? They say, yeah, we'll ride with you. I say, the object for us to ride on this train is to have some philosophical discussion about the pros and cons of an Olympic boycott. All I'm asking you to do, basically, is give up 15 minutes in the sun. Because that's what you have, 15 minutes to receive your medal, and it's over. So I said to him, I'm sorry, now we're on the train. Let's throw it on the cards on the table. Let's talk about the pros of the boycott. Let's talk about the negatives of the boycott. I say, I just want you to realize that what I'm talking about doing will be something that will be everlasting. So you're talking about something that will be for 15 minutes in your life. I say, because 5 years after the Olympics is over, they don't remember who won the 100 meters. They don't remember who won the 200 meters. I say, but you can do something that will be everlasting. So in the meantime, while we're rolling down the tracks, you saw people outside, they had the banners out, the flags out, just like when we was in the military. We was going to war. And everybody outside saying, God bless America, they cheered us on because we're their warriors. So as we go down the track, someone says, hey man, you know, I have a lot better understanding now about why this boycott is necessary. You said we have a consensus, we have understanding. Let me find the red lever. I'll pull the red lever to stop the train. What you stopping the train for? Well, if we have a consensus, man, it's no good to have a consensus and we just keep it confined to ourselves. We got to let the world know. So I'm stopping the train because now we're going to put the banners on the side of the train. 1968 boycott. Potential. All right, let's start the train back up again to try and start rolling. We look out the window now. All those people that was out there singing God Bless America and cheering us on, they gone. Not no more. So in other words, we don't have a right to make a decision for ourselves as to whether we feel something's good or bad. But in the place of them leaving, missiles, rockets, fire bombs came to the train. Train's still rolling, so on fire now, smoke everywhere. Mayhem, chaos. So now here we are 44 years later. And when someone walks up to me and want to take a picture, and I see a lot of those guys, they're telling me, move over, man, let me get in the picture. Or they build a statue 26 feet down there in San Jose State. Oh, man, let me get a brick with my name written on the base for the base of the statue. And I tell them, I say, man, I love you less than yesterday and, boy, more than tomorrow, but you can never get in the picture. You will never get a brick at the base of the statue. What are you talking about, man? We ran track together. See, because they're going to come up to you later when you're trying to get them to wake up. And once you go over the hill and be successful in whatever your endeavors are, then they're going to want to cry out there and take the picture with you. And what you tell them, say, listen, if you want to get in the picture, I have no problem letting you in, but you got to do one thing first. They say, what's that? I say, step on up here and open up your shirt. Pull up your pants leg. Roll up your sleeve. What you looking for? I'm looking for burns. If you don't have no burns on your body, that means when things got hot, you bailed. You understand? Because in your line of work trying to wake up society, things gonna get hot. The thing is, well, you had the gumption, the audacity to say, I defy what you do. I defy what you stand for. As I told people yesterday, the biggest problem that we have in this society right now is that we have a socialistic mind in a capitalistic society. That's everything. You have a social man. I don't have the money, but I think I should still be entitled to medical treatment. I don't have the money, man, but I think I should be entitled to push my kid to go to UCLA. But they tell you, you say, nah, man, if you don't have that money, I don't care how much brain you got, you ain't going to UCLA. You don't have that money, your furniture going to be on the street tomorrow. So once we get a balance in this and make our government have our understanding, say, man, if we're going to cover the people, we have to cover all of the people, not just the people that you choose to cover. That's what my fight is. See, my problem is that my buddies have a very severe problem. And their problem is they are afraid to offend their oppressors. They are afraid to offend their oppressors. They feel like, oh man, I understand what you're saying and I agree with what you're saying, but man, my theory is that when that chicken got on the fence and laid that egg, the egg stayed there, didn't fall to the right or to the left. Oh, well, my wife got pregnant, she wasn't pregnant, she was almost pregnant. No, either you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. Either the chicken laid the egg and it fell to the left or it fell to the right, but it did not stay on the fence. You have choices that you have to make when you start to write your stories. And you have to make the right choices. Because whatever you write, remember, it's for the duration of time. They can destroy a picture, but they can never destroy your words. Why did I use my athleticism where most guys sit up and talk about how great they are as athletes? I do it. I only do it to my wife, though. To my wife, I was a superstar. But relative to me getting out into the public, I don't talk about my athleticism. But I use my athleticism as a springboard, once again, to be a voice. Yeah, they would love for me to sit back and tell me, say, man, you out of place. You shouldn't be concerned about that. How can I be in a world and not have any concern about injustices in this world? We all have to realize that it could be you tomorrow because of your religion, because of what nation you came from or your heritage, because you have too much money. They might tell you, say, we coming after you just because you got too much money. I went down to Wall Street, to Occupy Wall Street in New York, excuse me, and it's always good to go back home. But when I went back to Wall Street, I told them, I say, why am I here? I'm here for you. Why am I here for you? Because I am you. 44 years ago, I decided to get involved in a fight. I don't get involved in fights other than do anything but win. And I told the people, I said, you know what kept me and gave me longevity is that God put it in my mind years ago, if you will realize that this life that you like, that you live, is a game. Anybody in this auditorium can tell me what's the concept of the game. Why are you in the game? You ain't in the game to lose. You're in the game to win. But my message to the people in Wall Street was, in order to win a game, you have to know the rules of the game. We studied real hard what we did in Mexico City. We studied what we did real hard leading up to Mexico City. We can't have individuals, we say we occupy Wall Street to go set a big fire and have them just probable cause to come in and start cracking heads and busting up upside the head. As it is right now, when someone come in and do mayhem and kill Trayvon Martin, and we know justifiably this man gunned him down, but we still going through changes to try and get some justice in that area. So now if someone sets up a situation for this kid to get killed, will you blame the perpetrator or do you blame the kid that led him into this situation? So all I'm saying is that we got to make sure that we're right in what we're doing. Mexico City, I was born to do that. I tell people I came on this planet to do that based on the fact that when I was 7 years old, God gave me a vision. And you always question yourself, you know, when God give you something, it's, you feel like a guy being in the military and all the platoon got killed and you're the only one lived. For the rest of your life, you asking God, why did you save me? Well, God gave me a vision, and for 67 years down there, at least for the 60 years for sure, I've been asking, why did you choose me, Lord? To show me on my wall one morning, me in a forum. I didn't even know what a stadium was at the time. So I say a forum. Well, all the people was in there, and there was Yippee-ki-yay, and they were so excited. And I'm in the middle of the field on a box. He didn't put nobody out on this box with me. I'm there by myself. I'm right-handed. I always did everything with this right hand. In this vision, when it dawned on my little brain that these individuals was applauding for me because no one was out there but me. And I went to wave, and I put my left hand up to wave, and I got my hand up about that high. And that all the happiness and joy turned to anger and venom. Stormy weather, spitting, throwing things, name calling, telling me where to go. And that vision that shook me up so bad. 15 years later, I was on the victory stand in Mexico City. First thing that came to my mind, and you have to forgive my language, the first thing in my mind, I said, oh, shit. That's what that vision was about.
Smith running pretty well so far. And in lane two, Bombuk is strong on the outside. It's Edwin Roberts. It's John Carlos right now. It's Carlos and Smith. And here comes Tommy Smith.
Because the exact same thing that happened in that vision as a little boy happened to me when I was 23 years old. I'm not left-handed. I'm right-handed. When I had that glove on, I had it on my left hand. You heard many stories about old John Collins left his gloves home. Nonsense. It was only one pair of gloves. Mr. Smith had the gloves. I had the idea. Okay? Why did I wear the beads? I put the beads on because I experienced so many young individuals when I was a kid hearing about them dying in the South because of lynching. I wanted to be in cognizant and remembrance of those individuals. Why do we wear black socks with no shoes? Because we thought about the people of color, not here in the United States, but around the world, that was living in poverty every day. We're the greatest nation in the world. They sending spaceships to the moon and tell me they can't kill a cockroach. I'm not buying it. So when you start to write, you have to write and elevate these things to a point where people can understand why you have so much passion in the work that you do. Because that's the thing that carries you over, is the passion for what you do. I have passion for the human race. I love people. But I don't like nobody to want to try and override everyone's situation. Now you sit back and think about, when you write, make them understand the difference in walking down the street and having a good time and the difference in walking down the street and falling out with a heart attack and can't breathe and you got a black man or a black woman running over to try and put them big black lips on you to give you life. Do you have time to be prejudiced or biased or racist at that time? No. Sit back and tell them at the same time when you write, tell them, say, hey, why is it the only time that we come together is when we have a major catastrophe from God? We have a hurricane. Everybody get together. We love one another then. We have a fire. We all just boil this water together. We love one another then. The minute the tsunami's over and done, then everybody go back into their own separate individual ways. And it's not your fault. We were taught this from grade school, from middle school to high school, and even on the college campuses, you will see it too. Segregation. The Hispanics sit together, the blacks sit together, the whites sit together. We might have one or two cross the line, and they be vilified for crossing the line. And then when you sit back and you say, who do you see other than the school or the institution where they have this segregation going on? It's the state penitentiary. The same thing, you taught this. They teach me about history, the little history they did teach me about, but they never taught me about the culture of other ethnicities. I don't know nothing about the Italians, no more than he's Italian. I could tell the Italian, say, man, you closer to me than this guy. I said, why? I said, look at the color of your skin, man. I said, a guy named Hannibal came. Do you know about Hannibal? Let's talk about that. Okay? But they don't teach us about the different cultures. And the educational system, where I talk about racism in the educational system, why is it that we really still got the box closed relative to teaching about different ethnic groups in this society? They're going to have games like that, and you have to be the ones to write about these games. If you shun your responsibility and say, I'm going to tell some of the story, you as bad as the guys that for 44 years came to John Collins and said, John, I want to interview you. What do you want to interview me for? I want to tell your story. But when all the dust settles, they tell their story. They don't tell my story. They pick out the parts that they think is relevant to what they want to run across to people, but things that I think is the meat of the story, they want to shun that. As writers, it's your responsibility to put in the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Don't worry about what people might say now. As I stated, they won't want to get in the picture later. They'll be knocking you out the way. I have one last situation that we're going to answer some questions too. When I was a kid, I had a situation with my mom. My mom used to come in, she worked at Bellevue, she was a nurse at Bellevue, and she's working nights, you know, we'd give up her nights with her man to bring a few much extra dollars in the house. So my mother would come in the morning, and all the kids be downstairs, we'd playing stickball the whole 9 yards, and the parents sitting in the benches. And my mother would come in, and she'd give me the nod, and she'd walk right on upstairs. She wouldn't, you know, she's booting the women going upstairs. So one day, I'm upstairs, and I said to my mother, I said, Mom, I said, how come you don't never come downstairs and talk to the other women, sit on the bench and talk to them? Are you stuck up? And my mother looked at me. She said, what did you say? I like the dummy. Are you stuck up? And when I look back, my mother had tears in her eyes. And my mother said to me, she said, I've never raised my kids to think I was better, they were better than anyone, and I've never carried myself to think I was better than anyone. I said, well, Mom, how come you don't come downstairs and sit down? And she said to me, she said, Johnny, I work in the operating room. She said, I can't go in the operating room with sores on me. See, we had an infestation of caterpillars. And if you, anyone know about caterpillars, they're so fragile, if you, one of them fall on your neck and you go back to wipe it off, you know, busting, by the time you get your hand in your waist, you got a rash in your neck. So I said, oh, that's valid. I like that answer, Mom. I'll take care of it. I went straight the next morning to the manager's office in the project. I said, we have a problem. I said, what's the problem? I said, man, these caterpillars. Now, mind you, I used to go up to the High Bridge pool in the white area. They had the same trees, minus the caterpillars, because they sprayed them every year. We have a problem with these caterpillars. What are you talking about? Get out of my office. And now, first time I learned that they had a panic button. Push the panic button, next thing you know, police and the guards, then they dragging me out. I broke back and went in his office and said, man, you got 48 hours. And that was my pet peeve. I give him 48 hours, what my father used to give me. You got 48 hours. If you don't handle the problem, I will. So the police looked at me and said, you threatening that man? I said, no, I'm not threatening him, but I did give him a money back guarantee. If he don't do it, I will. I waited 48 hours, didn't do anything. I told all the women, go down to the other end of the project or go upstairs. It's going to be some problems around here. I went down to the gas station. My partner's father owned the gas station. Got some. My father sent me to get some gas. He said, where's the bucket? He said, he didn't give me one. He said, well, back there, get one. I got the biggest one I can find. Fill it up with gas. He said, where the money? He said, he'll take care of you later. I got the gas. Now I'm rolling. Now I get it with four trees. Come through, there's a tunnel coming down, and then there's two trees on each side. Well, the first tree I went down there and hit, and we used to have stick matches. I hit that with my zipper, threw it on there, and just, poof, fire jumped out. And all the people were running around, oh, crazy Johnny, watch it, Johnny's crazy, he's doing something. I heard that all my life. So anyway, by the time I go to the next tree and dump the tree, I couldn't even get to the match, fire and leaped over. Now, everybody in the politics is running like ballistic. I get over to the third tree, I hit the third tree, I hit my match again, throw it on there. Now, by that time, the police didn't come and the guard, and they didn't know whether they should jump on me or try and put the fire out. Or when they hesitated, I hit the fourth tree. Then they wrestled me to the ground. Now I have to go to court. Took me to jail. I go to court. Now here's the story. My mother telling my father, say, Earl, I don't know what that boy gonna do next. I'm so embarrassed, I'm not going down there to watch them lock my baby up. I'm not going. You're going to have to go. So my father said, all right. So we get down, we go into court. My father said, well, son, I want you to know me and your mom love you, your brother, sister love you, but don't look like you're coming home. Don't look like they're going to keep you on this one. And my father never said one time, why did I do it? We got in the court, and the judge asked my father, says, Mr. Carlos, he says, does your son have any mental deficiencies? My father said, none that I know of. He said, well, why would he do what he did? And my father said, you know, Your Honor, that's a good question, but he's here. Why don't you ask him? And I told the judge, I said, Your Honor, I said, I asked my mother why she don't come downstairs. And she explained to me she don't come downstairs due to the caterpillars. I said, and she's absolutely right. She should have the same right to come downstairs and sit down as well as any other parent here. But based on her job, she couldn't come because the project is infested with caterpillars. I say, the white folks up there, I go to their pool up there, they spray their trees every year. They don't have the same problem we had. So the judge looked at the manager. He said to the manager, he says, when the last time you guys sprayed? The judge waited for the answer. The guy said, well, Your Honor, I don't really have that information here. So the judge looked at him and said, well, look, I'll tell you what you do. It's time for lunch. We're going to take a lunch recess. When you come back, you have your records with you. But the judge was a smart man and a fair man, because when we went to recess, He went back in his chambers and he called up the New York City Housing Authority and told them to come down with their records in terms of how much money they give for the spray every year. We come back from lunch now. My father tell me now, son, things don't look good. He's like browbeating me, boy. Your mom is crying. She's embarrassed. And all the people in the projects are concerned. We get back to court. Says, is the manager here? The manager come up and he brings up a little folder, one slip of paper in it. He tells the judge, say, Your Honor, he says, my secretary is out ill today and I don't know where all the records are. The judge said, okay, sit down. Is anyone here from the New York Housing Authority? Here a guy come up, he got a big bustling, one of them accordion like type folders. He said, do you have your records in there? Can you tell me how often the city receives money, the Housing Authority from Harlem River Houses receive money for the spray? Looked. He said, every year, sir. He says, every year. He said, well, how many times they said that they didn't spray? Check again. He said, they spray it every year, sir. So the man looks at my father. He didn't look at me. He said, Mr. Scouse. He said, when is the last time you remember him spraying? He said, well, Johnny's a teenager now. So we moved into this project. He was a little baby playing the wading pool. I said, you see, he ain't no baby no more. And they haven't sprayed since we was a little kid in that pool. He looks at the manager. He looks at my father. He said, are you sure? My father said, yes, sir. They fired the manager before we could leave the courtroom. Now, the bottom line, what I'm trying to say is, it might look bad for you by what you say. You might be ridiculed by people for writing what you have to write. But in the long run, God gonna see that you come out on top because you're doing the right thing. So when we left the courtroom, my father said something to me that stands out in my life today and probably be with me for the rest of my life. My father told me, he said to me, he said, son, I can't tell you about the pride that I have right now based on what happened in that courtroom. And I thought that was like the greatest thing in the world, your dad tell you about how proud he is. But then he went one step farther to tell me about how much respect he had for me. And that's a heavy statement for a father to tell his kid about having respect. You know about the pride and the love thing. But when he told me about the respect and then told me, he said, I respect you, son, because you've done a lot of things in your life. And I might not have understood them because I put that 48-hour move on you and I got that button many times. He said, but you never back down for what you believe in. And if you guys are here with that passion for the job that you took, never back down. Because what you're writing for, it's not for your life today. It's for your kids and your kids' peers. That's why we buy a house, not for us to live in. We're leaving something for our kids. We're pushing our kids to get an education, not for me to stick my chest out that my kids got a doctorate degree or my kids got a BA. I want my kids to have the best. And the only way you're going to leave a true legacy is through your words, through what you put down. Let them feel what you write. Let them understand why you feel what you write. I'm just merely giving some little essay. Put your passion into it. God bless you and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Later, the silent protest resonates as never before. Today, these demonstrators are generally regarded as heroes. At the time, however, they were widely understood as dangerous, angry, and anti-American. As I listen to Carlos share his experiences, I'm reminded of what James Baldwin said about related efforts. I love America more than any other country in the world, he said, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. They criticized America because they expected more from people. Carlos called attention to ongoing injustices because he has always had faith that things could change. Carlos inspires me, as I'm sure he inspires you. He is unquestionably an American hero. And to be completely frank, that is a little bit intimidating. An extraordinary person like Carlos can make a real difference. But what about far more ordinary people like me, like many of my students, like the vast majority of people that we might encounter in everyday life? As I think about that demonstration in Mexico City, the question I keep asking myself is what might a global rhetorical event like this have to teach us about rhetoric in our everyday lives? Few of us will ever have this kind of access to a global audience. However, that does not mean access is unavailable to the rest of us. Carlos's story also reminds me of the extraordinary strength of ordinary people and the ubiquity of the local, even on the global stage. Indeed, the vast majority of rhetoric in our everyday lives takes place at local levels. In language as a local practice, Alistair Penny Cook insists that, indeed, everything happens locally. No matter how global an event, it still always happens locally. Carlos frequently describes his activism as a series of discrete but related events experienced at very local levels. The first time he heard Malcolm X on the radio, for example, his fight with the New York Housing Authority on behalf of his mother, his first exposure to Jim Crow's legacy as a brand new college student arriving from Harlem at the Dallas airport in 1966, even his first direct link to the global movement that fueled his demonstration the following year in Mexico City in 1968. Carlos locates that moment of contact between the global and the local at the East Texas Post Office, where he picked up his latest issue of Track and Field and turned to an article about the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Even that global protest in Mexico City happened locally. For Norman, Smith, and Carlos, as they heard the national anthem play and saw the flag begin to rise, for the audience watching the events unfold from their stadium seats overlooking the field, for the millions of viewers witnessing it as it was broadcast into their living rooms. This notion of space as it relates to activism has motivated the vast majority of my research in this area, especially where the circulation of text is involved. For a more in-depth discussion, check out the references that are provided as the episode description, including the video introduction. The silent protest offers a powerful example of the discrepancies that always accompany activism. Change takes time. As Angela Davis reminds us, the victories that happen are not always the ones we fought for, but we should still be celebrating. Her work with the Black Panthers during the same era provides another example of this impact and the slow process. That process is never ending. As long as humans live together, injustices will persist. Still, we must continue to fight. We just have to continue to fight. We will never get the change we want, but as Dr. Carlos reminds us, as long as we keep working for it, the world will continue its development as a more just place for everyone.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.